Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Anuradha Mittal. Anuradha is a co-director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy here in Oakland, California. It's sometimes known as Food First, and does really wonderful work. And Anuradha Mittal just got back from the Earth Summit in Johannesburg, yesterday or something, hot off the press. I'm really excited to be able to get your ideas, and they're so fresh about what happened in Johannesburg. From what I've been hearing, and I don't think it's been much covered in the corporate press, but I've been listening to KPFA here, and it's been a lot covered. You've been on it some of the time, and it seems that a lot of people were very disappointed. What was your impression?
First of all, thank you, Sue, for having me on your show. Yes, the summit in Johannesburg, for many of us, the international civil society, turned out to be a meaningless photo opportunity. This was a summit which was basically looking back at the progress made towards commitments that were made 10 years ago at the Rio summit. Unfortunately, for many of us, it did not feel like it was Rio plus 10, but it really felt like Doha plus 10. Because 10 months ago, the WTO ministerial was held in Doha, Qatar. And so we were disappointed by the way we saw corporations change from polluters to become partners in this period of 10 years. We also saw the landless not being dealt with or not being considered as a major group. And their concerns and issues of equity were completely ignored and marginalized in the summit. But the biggest disappointment as a group based in the United States is the failure of the United States government to take responsibility, and especially as the largest polluter on this planet Earth, to kind of clean up the mess. So many of us have come back disillusioned from the official summit. However, the excitement still remains when we think of the international civil society, the landless movement that came together from around the world to deal with issues of how we protect our environment, how do we deal with issues of social and economic injustice.
How many people were there at this, the Alternative Summit? I don't know what it's called, but I know that there were people from all over the world who weren't the official delegation to that the conference that was the corporate conference, from what I hear.
Well, we know that the official delegates were 5,000. These are the government delegations. And from what I heard, that over 50,000 individuals had been accredited by the United Nations Secretariat to participate in the summit as NGOs participants. But in terms of people who are actually there from the civil society, the numbers range anywhere from 8 to 20,000. But also I want to point out that there was this whole other summit, the Week of the Landless, that was being organized by the National Land Committee, by the Landless People's Movement of South Africa, which had brought landless activists from Brazil, for example, members of the movement of landless workers in Brazil, to landless workers from Indonesia and from the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that it was a wonderful place to make connections.
Oh, definitely. It was definitely a place to strategize, to meet up with activists. For example, I met with Fatima, who is from Somalia, and in fact, she was the only representative from her country because there is no government, and she works around issues of commons and what's happening to livelihoods of pastoralists, the fisher folk, and how the livelihoods are being destroyed by industrial trawlers and fishing by illegal in illegal ways by corporations, and since there's no government to protect the fisher folk. At the same time, meeting with activists from Bolivia who were working together with activists from South Africa challenging privatization of water. Mm-hmm. There were farmers from around the world who are members of Via Campesina, which is the world's largest farmers' organizations. So personally for me, it was a really exciting time to be able to strategize, get to know struggles, and share experiences with activists who are working on issues of landlessness, women's rights, you know, issues of sustainability, you know, all kind of issues from around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. And it was huge, right? There were many, it was all spread out and many different things going on. How did you manage?
Well, that was one of the very difficult things to deal with, because on one hand, you had the official summit, which was organized in Stanton Convention Center, this rich and fancy convention center, where the official delegates were coming together and some of us were accredited to go in. Then there was the NGO summit, which, given the traffic and distance, was almost like 42 minutes to 60 minutes away at Nazareth Center, and you needed to pay $150 to be able to participate in this NGO summit, which resulted in exclusion of many people. And then there was ShareWorld, a very down-to-earth place where the landless were holding the summit of the landless for a week. And compared to Stanton, the delegates here were sleeping on a foam mattress on the floor. And then there was Water Dome, which was completely taken over by corporate interest, and they were talking about bringing clean drinking water to people. But even if the minuscule of resources that were spent on this Water Dome were actually spent to provide clean drinking water to people, we would live in a different world.
And of course, the issue of water is a really major, major issue right now, and I don't know that even most listeners understand how serious it is. So I'd like to share something about that, Anuradha.
Well, as Maud Barlow, one of the activists who's involved in the struggle, has said, that some of the future wars among countries might be fought around water. What we are seeing is corporations recognizing that water is something which is so essential for our existence, and we're beginning to see privatization of water. Many of the listeners might be familiar of the struggle of the people of Cochabamba in Bolivia, where Bechtel had privatized water and the communities fought back. But that struggle can also be seen in the townships such as Alexandra near Johannesburg, where water, electricity, our commons are being privatized. And so access and control over these resources would be by companies such as Vivendi and the others. And that is being fought back, because this is really about our commons. This is really about our human rights. This is really about a basic existence.
Yeah, it's just so nasty to think of charging for water. And I know that in Bolivia, it was like one quarter of people's income or something they had to pay for water just to get enough to drink. So that's a really positive story, in that people standing up against Bechtel made it stop, basically, the privatization of water. So we really need all these positive examples that we can get. Maybe you heard about some other ones, or you know about some other positive examples of people standing up and changing things.
Well, definitely Bolivia, as you've said, Sue, is an inspiration to struggles against commodification of our resources, such as seeds and water, as a very inspirational story and an example. But just in the townships of Soweto, for example, where electricity and water has been privatized, and the poor do not have access to the basic amount that they would need, while the rich have full access to water their golf courses, to wash their cars, to bathe their pets. Given that situation, their supply to water has been cut off because, as you said, in the case of Bolivia, just before they can get access to the basic amount they need for existence was almost a quarter of their income. The same thing is happening in Soweto. So their water supplies have been cut off, and I met this beautiful young woman, Tobago, who's part of the Soweto Electricity and Water Crisis Committee, who organized a group of people who went to the mayor's house, who had failed to respond to the needs, and cut off his water and electricity so he could get a taste of what it feels like to not have basic amenities in life, to put a dollar value to it, thereby allowing only people with fat pockets and wallets to be able to have these things. So this whole commodification process is being challenged. But as I said, the stories are amazing, and they're from all over the world. And it was that kind of sharing of stories and which kind of really formulated learning experience for the communities who had gathered from around the world at the summit.
Do you think there's going to be much follow-up action that people coordinate? And, of course, for people who are poor, just to get there must have been an enormous, enormous stretch, to say the least, to go from Brazil, landless workers of Brazil, to go from Brazil to South Africa costs probably $2,000.
Well, definitely that's a big issue where the international civil society is beginning to question these resources that are used to organize these big circuses almost, these big galas for the rich and the famous, and what the best use of resources is. So, of course, in terms of follow-up, the struggle is not yet over. We might be disappointed by failure of U.S. government and the focus on trade. This struggle is not over. This is a struggle for a planet Earth. There is only one Earth that we have. So we cannot let the outcome of WSSD summit in Johannesburg, which was completely dominated by Washington consensus, to be the final outcome. So this struggle shall continue. This struggle shall continue, for example, at the upcoming meeting in Quito around the free trade area of the Americas. There's strategy meetings happening to how do we kind of plan our struggle around the next WTO ministerial, which will be in Cancun, Mexico. So this struggle will continue to ensure that people's basic human rights, their right to safe environment, the right to water, right to food, are fulfilled. The struggle to ensure that there are no patents on life shall continue. We are all facing the impact of global warming, so the struggle for climate justice shall continue as well.
Yeah, and we know that this affects all of us some way or another eventually. It's so hard to understand how these people cannot understand that there's really no escape. We're just, I mean, it's a lot more comfy for some people than others, but really there's no escape since we're all in this same large ecosystem here. I just heard that Russia pulled out of the Kyoto Treaty. The global warming, no? You haven't heard that?
I had heard that they had actually signed on to it. So they had signed on to it, which basically really excludes countries like the U.S., which have refused to sign on to it. So it's actually really path-breaking Russia has decided to join the thing, the Kyoto Protocol. And that's the kind of struggle that shall continue. We need to build support. We need to build a momentum, especially within the United States, which has been the largest polluter of greenhouse gases, that we need to pay up, and we need to take responsibility for the destruction of this earth and environment. And Sue, as you said, this kind of pollution is not something which can be contained within borders. This is not just something happening in other countries. The effects are being felt by our communities. The effects will be felt by our future generations, by our children. So it is our responsibility as the current generation to take responsibility for our past and current actions. And this, perhaps, still time to be able to make amends. So we need to act on it now before it's too late.
I heard a recording of Spicer, I think his last name is, the man from Canada. One of the things that he said is that all the seeds, now all the crops, not just the seeds, all the crops in Canada, the whole country of Canada, which is a huge country, have been polluted. There's no more organic food. They've been polluted by these Monsanto genetically modified seeds. So that's already happened. And that's the kind of thing that is not, it made me think when you said not containable.
Well, you're talking about Percy Schmeiser, this Canadian farmer who was sued by Monsanto for patent infringement, because though he was not using Monsanto canola seeds, Monsanto's detectives were able to find traces of the genes of the seeds in his crop, because you cannot contain genetic pollution. And that's, yes, what I'm talking about. And what Percy says is that it's very difficult to grow canola, which would not have the genes of Monsanto seeds in Canada now. And that was, again, a very big issue at the summit, because we were meeting in South Africa, and Southern Africa is facing famine, which is, according to some estimates, affecting over 13 million people. And countries such as Zimbabwe and especially Zambia and Mozambique have put up a fight around not accepting contaminated food aid from United States, which is contaminated with genetically modified organisms. And United States has been pushing this GM food aid on these countries. And in fact, Colin Powell actually held Zambian government responsible for starvation for not accepting U.S. food aid. Now, the question is, why is U.S. so keen on denying Zambia or Zimbabwe or Mozambique or Malawi their sovereign right to be able to decide what they will eat and how they will eat it? And if there is a political commitment to bring food aid to the hungry, to the starving, there is enough non-GMO food that could be provided to the communities. So once again, we saw corporate interests dominating the interests of our policymakers, and they were once again pushing GM crops to be able to take over the markets and destroy markets for non-GM crops.
Yeah, it's really amazing that they're refusing to take them, because in the United States, probably most people, I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't. I think that's really incredibly impressive that they are starving and refusing to take genetically modified food. Whereas most people in the United States, I think, are eating, and a lot of places are eating genetically modified food and don't even know it. And when they know it, don't seem to really care.
Well, Sue, the issue is one of, as USAID said, beggars cannot be choosers. But Zambia has said that we have a scientific process, regulatory agencies. We need to go through our own process to do risk assessment of these crops. Because if you look at the case of Mexico, where food aid was planted, which resulted in the genetic contamination of the diversity of center of maize. Now, that is a big threat to, you know, food security, not just national, but also international. Do we really want to contaminate our diversity centers of different crops? So Zambia, I think, is thinking long term. They need to do their own risk assessment. They have regulatory agencies. And I would say this is what democracy looks like, and it should be allowed to be a democratic country, which operates by going through a process of designing their own national policies. So it is wrong of United States at this point to be pushing. The other big concern for these African nations is that if they start growing genetically modified crops, their exports to Europe will be deeply affected, because Europe has a clear policy around GM crops. So it almost seems like U.S. is using third world countries in its proxy war with Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I know that food, you know a lot about a lot of issues, Anuradha Mittal, and you work with Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. In fact, you're the co-director. And I know that you talk about starvation in the United States as one of the subjects that you write and speak about. Let's talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Well, Sue, I think we live in some unfortunate times, because on one hand, there's never been as much food and abundance as we see in today's world. According to the research done at Food First, there is enough food to provide over 4.3 pounds of food per person per day around the world. And yet we are seeing hunger increase. Over 815 million people just in the developing world do not have enough to eat.
I'm going to interrupt you and kind of repeat that, because I think that most people don't understand that there is enough food for everybody in the world. I mean, they blame it on all kinds of things, but in fact, I mean, they blame hunger on all kinds of things, but in fact, there is, what'd you say, 4 pounds plus of food?
4.3 pounds of food per person per day around the world. And a classic example of that is America, the richest nation on earth, where we're seeing hunger increase. Just according to the United States Department of Agriculture, over 36 million Americans do not have adequate access to food. Now, these are not figures that are coming from the Institute. These are the official figures. Our figures would be much higher. And you can track it down then as to why we have hunger, given this is a land of plenty. It is totally related to people's shortage of purchasing power. It is not the shortage of production. It is because of the absence of living wage jobs. It is policies such as free trade agreements, which have seen a decline in purchasing power of people. We have seen decline in real wages of people. So it is those kind of policies which have forced people to make a choice between having a roof over their head or food on the table.
Yeah. And there's always so much politics involved. I mean, there's of food, really. If you would, explain a little bit more about that and how it gets used.
Well, see, I would just say about food that food is both personal and political. You know, it is personal because each one of us needs it. It goes inside us every day. It's also political, right from the act of picking something up from a market shelf. You know, we make a choice, and that choice can be determined by who grew it, how did that food get there, did the person who grew it get to eat it, how many miles it traveled to get there. So there are all kind of questions related to that. But also food is so essential to our lives that anyone who can control the food system gets to control us. Anyone who can control the nation's food supply gets to control the nation. Food has been used as a political weapon all the time, whether we think of embargoes, against Cuba, against Iraq, or we look at controlling of, you know, populations. You know, hunger and poverty is people think is a wonderful way of controlling populations, forcing them into jobs that do not have human dignity, that do not pay a living wage. So food is something very essential to us, and that is why it has been used over and over again as a political weapon. I just mentioned the case of food aid to African countries. Because the people are starving, U.S. can use food aid as a political weapon to determine the choice around genetically modified foods, to control the process that they need to go through with their regulatory agencies. So food is totally political, and and that is why you would realize that companies such as Monsanto are so keen, for example, to buy seed companies. Because if you control the seed, you control the first step of the food chain. You basically control the entire food chain.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you could explain to people about the seeds, the Terminator seeds. Because, again, I think that many people don't understand how serious this is.
Well, in this increasing control over of a food system, we have seen control of our seeds. And one of the technologies that they've come up with is the Canadian group ETC, which used to be called RAFI, calls Terminator technology. Terminator technology is, you know, over a billion farmers in this world save seeds to be able to use them for the next, you know, harvest. And the seed companies such as Monsanto would like to see farmers dependent on buying seeds from them each time. So they've created these seeds which are basically sterile. That is, if you plant them, they will not give you seeds for the next year. So you're forced to go back to the company to buy your seeds each year. So this would result in the loss of biodiversity. This is the ultimate control of our nature, where we can render nature sterile, where basically we force farmers to give up their old cultural ways and their innovation and make them dependent on chemical companies like Monsanto to buy seeds year after year. And this technology has been challenged. There was a moratorium that was put on it, and yet our research and work on it has still continued, and people need to know about it. Terminator technology will basically render our seeds infertile. It would result in the control of a food system in the hands of few corporations. They could make us sabotage the entire food production by making all our seeds sterile. And, of course, there's no way to control the genetic pollution that would be happening.
And it's really important to save seeds. Saving seeds is something that people really need to do. I mean, the idea that we can't have our own seeds, that you can't plant a garden without or a field without paying money to somebody, and that it's going to, you know, sterilize because it moves into these seeds move around, not just the seeds, the pollen, the plants. Just an incredibly serious thing, and one of the best things people can do now is to save seeds.
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's also about our biodiversity, the diversity that we had in seeds. And if we were to render that diversity to be sterile, our whole food security, our entire food chain would be destroyed. And also not to mention the role that women have played as seed savers, the innovation that has taken place on the fields by the knowledge of farmers that has been passed on from generation to generation. It can never be replaced by scientists in labs. It can never be replaced by these Monsanto seeds. So it is not just about a cultural experience. It is also about our national, international food security. It is about food sovereignty. It is about our biodiversity. And the price that we are being asked to pay would be enormous. Are we willing to give that up?
When you use the word food security, what exactly do you mean by that expression? And if you could connect it, we only have a very short time left, but if you want to just make a connection with women.
By food security, actually, I would say it really means our human right to be able to feed ourselves. It means that we have the choice of being able to grow what we want to grow and grow it in ways that we want to. So food security really means that people having access, adequate access to safe, nutritious food, and that it is not just an aspiration to work towards, but it's really our human right.
And maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about the Institute for Food and Policy Development, Food First, in the couple minutes we have left, because I know you have lots of information that people can send for, and you do other things besides that.
Well, there's tons of information that people can find on our website, so I would urge listeners to check out our website at www.foodfirst, which is one word, .org. Once again, it is foodfirst.org. And it is a policy think tank. We do research, analysis, education for action around issues of hunger, poverty, environmental degradation, agriculture, economic and social human rights, such as the right to food. So there's a lot that people can find out from our website about genetically modified crops and how to challenge these genetic engineering, and of course ways on getting in touch with us. It's all there on our website, and I would urge people to check it out.
Well, and we've been talking in this interview about food and water. You can't get much more basic. I guess there's air, there's earth. But food and water, we just won't do well without food and water. And already a lot of people are having a very hard time, to put it mildly. And women are especially important in the mix of food.
Well, definitely, if you look at developing countries, women play a very crucial role in food production. They are the seed savers. They are the ones who are, you know, growing maize in the valleys of Africa. They are the ones who are working in the paddy fields in Asia. They are the ones who are working, growing corn in Latin Central America. So we cannot ignore the role that women play. And unfortunately, they are the ones often who do not have titles to the land on which they work. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who are the first ones to go hungry when there's starvation or famine. They're the first ones to balance the budgets by their poverty and hunger when our commons are privatized. So really working around food issues and food security, for me personally, is really working for women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all the interviews I'm doing lately come around to the same subject all the time, how everything is connected. So I want to thank you very, very much for giving me this time. I know you're jet-lagged, exhausted, and ready to go off again. Anuradha Mittal, co-director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, and my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.